overflowing with noise, shallow takes, and information that evaporates the moment you hear it, Solenius Media exists for one purpose: to give you depth. Whether the subject is philosophy, psychology, history, science, artificial intelligence, literature, or the shape of the future, every series we publish is built on one idea: that thinking clearly is a form of survival. You're listening to a Solenius Media production. Our catalog spans dozens of long-form, story-driven shows, from Western moral philosophy for beginners to pioneers of psychology and psychiatry, from AI and uncertain future to the classical music giants. Each series is crafted to give you more than facts. It gives you the context, the conflict, and the human meaning behind the ideas that shaped our world. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project. A guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. Visit the Solenius Media channel to discover new series, follow your favorites, and support the work that allows us to create long-form, high-fidelity, educational storytelling. And please leave comments if you enjoy our shows. Now, let's begin. Produced by Solenius Media. On a clear Athenian afternoon in the late 5th century BCE, when the heat on the white stone steps of the law courts shimmered like water, a stranger from the west walked into the city and changed the sound of public speech. He came not in armor, but in a richly woven cloak, with a small entourage and a reputation that had traveled ahead of him. A man whose words could dazzle crowds, unmake reputations, and twist the most settled opinions into something new. His name was Gorgias of Leontini, and for a brief, intense moment in the history of Greek thought, he stood at the center of a question that will haunt Western moral philosophy from then on. If language can make the weaker argument seem stronger, what becomes of truth and justice? Gorgias was born around 485 BCE in Leontini, a Greek city in Sicily. Southern Italy and Sicily were, his day, places of wealth and turmoil. Greek colonies mixed with native populations. Tyrants rose and fell. Alliances shifted. It was a region where legal and political institutions were continually being reinvented, and where the power of persuasive speech had become a matter of survival. Courts replaced vendettas. Assemblies replaced the edicts of kings. To win a case or push a law through, one needed not only a claim, but a voice, a style, a presence. Gorgias grew up in that environment and turned it into an art. We know little of his youth in detail. Later stories say he studied with Empedocles, though the connection is likely more symbolic than literal. Both men came from the West. Both mingled poetry with philosophy. Both loved paradox and performance. What matters is that by the time the Gorgias appears clearly in the historical record, he is already a celebrated orator. In 427 BCE, when the city of Leontini needed help against threats from Syracuse, they sent an embassy to Athens. Gorgias led it. He did more than deliver a diplomatic appeal. He gave Athens a demonstration. Ancient writers say that when Gorgias spoke before the Athenian assembly, the Athenians were stunned. They had heard great speakers before, Pericles and others, but this was something different. Gorgias played with sound, rhythm, and structure in a way no one had seen. His sentences rang with balanced clauses, parallel phrases, and unexpected reversals. He used antithesis, setting opposites side by side, to create a kind of verbal lightning. He coined new expressions, turned words on themselves, and made language itself the object of attention. To listen to him was not only to receive arguments, but to experience a performance. Students flocked to him. Like Protagoras, he was a sophist, a professional teacher of rhetoric and practical wisdom, charging high fees to those who wanted to learn. He taught in Athens and elsewhere, traveling through the Greek world with the confidence of someone who knows that wherever there are courts and assemblies, there will be a market for his skills. He did not pretend to be a sage in the old sense, delivering a cosmic doctrine. He offered instead mastery of logos, speech, argument, discourse, as a tool of power. To understand what Gorgias represents, you have to imagine the atmosphere of his time. The Peloponnesian War loomed. Athens, proud and restless, was locked in a decades-long struggle with Sparta. democratic institutions buzzed with debate. Should the city go to war here or there? Punish this ally or spare that one? Send a fleet, raise a tax, execute a general, ostracize a rival? Ordinary citizens, drawn by lot, sat on juries and voted on life and death matters. In such a world, the difference between a clever speech and a clumsy one could be the difference between exile and honor, between war and peace. Rhetoric was not decoration, it was a weapon. Gorgias understood this weapon more clearly than almost anyone. He saw that speech does not merely describe reality, it shapes how reality appears in the minds of those who hear. A plaintiff can describe a killing as murder or self-defense. A politician can portray a war as liberation or aggression. A defendant can cast himself as victim or villain. The facts do not speak by themselves. They must be arranged, framed, given a form. Gorgias turned this fact into a principle and asked the unsettling question: if what we take as just or unjust depends so heavily on how things are said, what is the status of justice itself? Three surviving works, all short, give us our most direct glimpse of his thought: The Encomium of Helen, The Defense of Palamedes, and a treatise known as On Non-Being or On Nature, preserved in later reports. Each is, in its own way, an exercise in what we might call ethical shock therapy. Take The Encomium of Helen. Helen of Troy, in the Greek imagination, was the woman whose beauty launched 1,000 ships. She abandoned her husband, Menelaus, and went to Troy with Paris, sparking a 10-year war. For centuries, she had been the epitome of feminine guilt, the one who caused countless deaths. Gorgias takes this entrenched moral verdict and flips it. He sets out to praise Helen, to absolve her of blame. He begins with a flourish, noting that praise and blame are powerful forces in cities. Poets and orators shape the reputations of the dead and the living. Then he turns to Helen and offers 4 possible explanations for her actions. If she left Sparta for Troy because of the will of the gods, then humans cannot fairly blame her. Divine compulsion is irresistible. If she was taken by force, then she is a victim, not a traitor. If she was persuaded by speech, then the blame lies with the speaker, not the hearer, because speech has a quasi-magical power to dominate the soul. And if she was swept away by Eros, love, then love is a kind of sickness or madness that overwhelms judgment. In each case, he concludes, Helen is not properly responsible for what happened. She deserves pity or admiration, not hatred. On the surface, this is a dazzling technical feat, taking a figure universally condemned and weaving an argument that exonerates her. But underneath, there is a serious reflection on the limits of human responsibility. If gods, violence, persuasion, and passion can all override reason, how often are we truly in control of our actions? How just are our judgments of others when we rarely account for the forces acting on them? In the course of this speech, Gorgias gives one of the most arresting descriptions of speech in all of Greek literature. Logos, he says, is a great ruler that, though small and invisible, accomplishes enormous deeds. Words can stop fear, remove grief, create joy, and instill pity. He compares speech to a drug. Just as some drugs purge disease and others poison, some words cure the soul and others corrupt it. A skilled speaker can enchant an audience, making them feel as if they are witnessing things that are not there. The power of speech over the order of the soul, he says, is like the power of drugs over the nature of bodies. This drug metaphor is central for understanding Gorgias's place in moral philosophy. He is not saying that speech is evil. Drugs can heal or harm, so can words. The danger lies in their potency. A listener who thinks he is simply hearing the truth when he listens to a gifted orator does not realize how much of his inner landscape is being rearranged. Persuasion is not a gentle presentation of facts. It is an intervention in psychology. The orator is, in a sense, a doctor or a sorcerer. In The Defense of Palamedes, Gorgias takes a different tack. Palamedes is a legendary Greek hero accused by Odysseus of treason during the Trojan War. In the traditional story, Odysseus resented Palamedes and framed him, leading to his death. Gorgias writes a speech in Palamedes' voice, defending himself before the Greek army. Here, the emphasis is less on lush metaphors and more on cold logic. Palamedes points out inconsistencies in the accusations, shows the improbability of the alleged conspiracy, appeals to practical reasoning. How could he have communicated with the enemy, bribed guards, moved undetected? The speech is a tour of early legal reasoning, one of the first examples of a purely rational defense, unassisted by character witnesses or emotional appeals. Again, the moral point is double-edged. On one hand, Gorgias equips his audience with sharper tools for seeing through false accusations. On the other, he shows how easily those same tools can be used by guilty men to escape justice. The power of reasoning, like the power of language in Helen's case, was morally ambiguous. It is not inherently tied to the good. The most philosophically radical of Gorgias's works is On Non-Being, which survives only in paraphrase by later authors. In it, he seems to argue three outrageous theses. First, that nothing exists. Second, that even if something did exist, it could not be known. Third, that even if it could be known, it could not be communicated. On the face of it, this is an assault on the very possibility of knowledge and language. Some scholars think Gorgias meant it as a parody of Parmenides, whose dense poem had claimed that being alone exists and can be known by reason. Where Parmenides affirmed being, Gorgias flips every term and defends non-being with elaborate argument, as if to show that one can build a plausible case for almost anything if one is clever enough. Whether we read On Non-Being as sincere skepticism or as an intellectual joke, its effect is destabilizing. It casts doubt on the philosopher's dream of a language that mirrors reality. If words cannot guarantee access to what is, if they can be turned in circles to support mutually incompatible theses, then maybe the project of metaphysics is itself suspect. Gorgias seems to revel in this possibility. His natural home is not the quiet study where someone contemplates eternal being, but the noisy court where rival speeches compete and nothing is permanently settled. This is why Plato treats him as such a serious opponent. In the dialogue Gorgias, Plato stages an encounter between Socrates and the historical Gorgias, along with two of his followers, Polus and Callicles. Socrates asks Gorgias what his art is. Gorgias answers, rhetoric, the craft of persuasive speech. What is its domain? Socrates pushes. Rhetoric, says Gorgias, is concerned with the greatest and most important human affairs, freedom and slavery, justice and injustice, the good of the city. A skilled orator can persuade citizens or jurors of anything he wishes, without himself needing to know the technical subject at hand. He can make the doctor seem ignorant about health, or the ship's captain ignorant about navigation if he speaks more compellingly. For Socrates, this is alarming. If rhetoric can overpower knowledge, then the city's decisions will be driven less by what is true or good than by what is pleasing or flattering to the audience. Rhetoric becomes, in Plato's phrase, a form of flattery, a knack rather than a genuine craft. It does not really care about the soul's health. It only cares about gratification. In the dialogue, Gorgias tries to avoid this conclusion by saying that a good rhetorician will use his power justly, but under questioning, he has to concede that his art, as such, does not guarantee justice. It is a powerful tool that can be used by unjust men to corrupt the many. Behind Plato's critique lies a crucial question for moral philosophy. Can there be a morally neutral skill of persuasion, or is any training in rhetoric already a training in manipulating others? Gorgias, by his practice, seems to answer that rhetoric can be separated from virtue. One can teach the forms of argument, the rhythms of speech, the tactics of emotional appeal, and leave it up to the student to decide whether to use them well or badly. Plato denies this. Any speech that aims at the soul, he insists, is already shaping its sense of value. To pretend that one is only offering tools is self-deception. The quarrel between Gorgias and Plato is not just a historical curiosity. It anticipates modern anxieties about advertising, propaganda, public relations, and political spin. When we teach young people how to pitch ideas, craft narratives, frame debates, are we giving them neutral communication skills, or are we inducting them into an art of manipulation that will eventually undermine their respect for truth? Gorgias might shrug and say, "This is simply how human beings are. They respond to stories, metaphors, images. To ignore this is naive. Better to learn how persuasion works and then decide how to use it." Plato would reply, "Once you treat truth as just another angle, you have already surrendered to a world in which what matters is not what is, but what sells." There is also the matter of beauty. Gorgias's speeches are consciously beautiful. He crafts them like poems, with alliteration, assonance, and symmetry. The Encomium of Helen, in Greek, is full of paired phrases that differ only by a syllable or two, balancing meanings like a seesaw. Style for him is not an afterthought. It is part of the content. A well-turned phrase does more than convey information. It moves the listener, pleases, seduces. Gorgias embraces that fact. If words are going to shape our experience of reality, we might as well shape them artfully. This raises another moral question. Is aesthetic pleasure in speech dangerous? Listening to a Gorgian performance, one can easily be swept away by the sheer music of the language and forget to ask whether the claims are true or the aims good. Plato feared precisely this. He worried that beautiful speeches could habituate citizens to judging proposals by how they sound rather than by what they will do. Gorgias, in contrast, seems to think that beauty is one of the few reliable pleasures in a chaotic world, and that denying it in the name of sober truth is a kind of self-mutilation. There is a way to see Gorgias not as an enemy of morality, but as its dark mirror. By pushing the power of language to an extreme, he forces later thinkers to be more honest about how much of our moral life is bound up with stories. Nations tell stories about their founding. Religions tell stories about creation and salvation. Families tell stories about their ancestors. Individuals tell stories about their own past. These stories may not be false in the crude sense, but they are always selective, framed, oriented towards certain values. Gorgias's celebration of rhetoric makes visible what is usually invisible, that our truths arrive dressed in words and the clothes matter. From the standpoint of your narrative arc in Western moral philosophy, Gorgias stands at a crossroads. On one road is the path of metaphysics and ethics that seeks stable, rationally defensible principles, Plato's forms, Aristotle's function of man, the Stoic logos. On the other road is the path that acknowledges the contingency and malleability of belief, the fact that humans live in and through language, that what they call justice is often the outcome of persuasive battles. Gorgias does not walk very far down either road. He dances between them, improvising. We do not know how his life ended. He reportedly lived to a great age, perhaps over 90, a long time for the ancient world. He amassed considerable wealth from his teaching, yet seems to have remained, personally, somewhat detached, more interested in speech itself than in holding office or directing policy. He was both central and marginal, central to the intellectual climate of his time, marginal to the enduring canon because his work lacks a single systematic doctrine. And yet, if you listen carefully, you can hear his influence echoing in later, more theoretical thinkers. When Aristotle insists that rhetoric is the counterpart of dialectic, a legitimate art that must be practiced ethically, he is responding to a Gorgian world. When Cicero writes about the ideal orator who unites wisdom and eloquence, he is trying to heal the split that Gorgias made visible between knowing and persuading. When modern theorists of discourse analyze how ideologies are reproduced through language, they are, knowingly or not, working along lines that Gorgias traced with his talk of speech as pharmakon. For your listeners, Gorgias offers a particular kind of unease. He used the moment in the story where the ground seems to give way under the feet of anyone who wants morality to rest on stable foundations. If arguments can be made on both sides of almost any question, if style can overwhelm substance, if skeptical paradoxes can be spun out endlessly, what hope is there? For a shared ethical reality? But he also offers a kind of honesty. He refuses to pretend that human beings are persuaded by reason alone. He forces us to contend with the fact that every moral reform, every ethical awakening, has always involved Not just better ideas, but more compelling language. Imagine him one last time, in Athens, or perhaps in Thessaly or Olympia, standing before a crowd as the sun lowers and the air cools. He begins to speak, and the murmurs fade. The words come, measured and bright, like stones laid in a pattern. People who walked into the gathering thinking one thing about Helen, or justice, or honor, feel their minds shifting, if only for a moment. Later, some will resist that shift, others will lean into it. But none will forget the sensation of being moved by speech itself. In that sensation lies both the peril and the promise that Gorgias embodies. The peril is obvious. We can be led astray, made to applaud what we should condemn, tricked into consenting to our own harm. The promise is more subtle. If language is that powerful, then it can also be turned toward truth as we painstakingly discover it, toward justice as we slowly reimagine it, toward solidarity as we learn to see one another's lives more clearly. Gorgias does not tell us which way to turn. He simply hands us the instrument and shows us what it can do. But to see just how far Gorgias pushes things, it helps to look more closely at the internal logic of his positions. In On Non-Being, the three-part argument is not a mere string of provocations. The first thesis, that nothing exists, is supported by attacking opponents on all sides. If one says that reality is one, like Parmenides' being, Gorgias presses on the difficulties of conceiving something without limits, qualities, or differences. If one says that reality is many, he presses on how multiplicity can be accounted for without lapsing into contradictions about divisibility and unity. His goal is less to convince you that absolutely nothing exists than to show that whatever metaphysical picture you choose, a skilled critic can pull it apart. By the end of the exercise, you begin to suspect that our ability to prove the existence or non-existence of fundamental entities has more to do with the flexibility of language than with any secure access to reality. The second thesis, that even if something did exist, it could not be known, turns our attention to the distance between the world and the mind. Sensation is fallible. Imagination distorts. Memory fades. Even basic perceptions vary from person to person. What is hot to one is worn to another. Straight seems bent when plunged into water. A distant object looks small. If all our knowledge begins in such shifting impressions, how can we ever claim to grasp things as they really are? Once again, Gorgias is not the first to raise such worries, but he heightens them and shows how easily they can support a general skepticism. The third thesis, that even if something could be known, it could not be communicated, is perhaps the most characteristic. It expresses his sense that the inner world of each speaker is inescapably private. I can have a certain experience, but when I speak, I do not transmit that experience itself. I send you sounds. Those sounds, heard by you, awaken your own associations, memories, and images. What guarantee is there that what awakens in you matches what lives in me? We live in separate chambers, tapping on the walls to one another. Sometimes the rhythms line up well enough that we act as if we share a common understanding. But for Gorgias, the possibility always remains that a gulf lies between what I mean and what you take me to mean. Here too, the moral dimension is never far away. If communication is inherently uncertain, then every act of persuasion contains an element of risk and potentially of violence. I am not simply sharing my thoughts with you. I am attempting, through words, to reach into your mind and alter its contents. If I do this knowingly in the service of deception, I am abusing the vulnerability that the very structure of language creates. If I do it in the service of some genuine conviction about justice, the danger does not disappear, but is joined by a kind of necessity. I cannot not attempt to persuade you, because our shared life depends on acting together, and acting together depends on some convergence of belief. To say that Gorgias is sensitive to this tension is not to claim that he solves it. He does not offer, as a later moralist might, a set of rules for responsible rhetoric. Instead, he amplifies the tension until it becomes impossible to ignore. His whole career is a kind of laboratory in which the explosive compound of language and power is mixed in full public view. Those who came to him for instruction learned not only how to build arguments, but also, if they were paying attention, how fragile arguments are. He also understood instinctively something that later philosophers would labor to articulate: that persuasion rarely happens at the level of explicit premises alone. When Gorgias spoke, he did not merely lay out chains of reasoning. He created a mood. The cadence of his sentences, the interplay of sound and sense, the careful alternation between short, sharp phrases and long, rolling periods, all of this worked on his listeners' bodies as well as their minds. They found themselves leaning forward, relaxing, frowning, laughing, nodding along, sometimes without being fully conscious of why. Before they could decide what they thought of his claims, they had already undergone an experience. From this standpoint, Plato's discomfort with him is easier to understand. Socrates wants argument to be conducted in a stripped-down register. Short questions and answers, careful definitions, the gradual tightening of logical nets. Gorgias revels in the fullness of spoken language, with all its emotional and aesthetic charge. Plato fears that in such fullness, the distinction between what is and what merely seems will be lost. Gorgias may suspect that the distinction is itself less clear-cut than philosophers like to believe. To bring Gorgias into the present, imagine him transported into a modern media environment. He would immediately grasp the logic of the televised debate, the viral clip, the advertisement, the campaign speech. He would see how a 30-second message can frame a complex issue as a simple choice. How a carefully placed story can transform public outrage into applause. How repetition and rhythm can turn slogans into something like secular prayers. He would also recognize that people in such an environment often mistake intensity of feeling for strength of argument. The more powerfully a message hits, the more true it seems. This in embryo is already present in his account of speech as Pharmakon. The question for any moral philosophy that comes after Gorgias is whether it can take this into account without surrendering to it. Can we acknowledge that human beings are moved by style, narrative, and feeling, and still insist that there is a difference between honest and dishonest speech, between persuasion that respects the listener's autonomy and persuasion that bypasses it? Can we develop an ethics of rhetoric that neither demonizes eloquence nor lets it run wild? Some later thinkers have tried. Aristotle's treatise on rhetoric is one such attempt. He accepts that any practical deliberation must appeal to ethos, the speaker's character, pathos, the audience's emotions, and logos, the argument itself. He does not pretend that pure logic is enough, yet he also insists that a good orator must use these appeals in a way that is guided by a genuine understanding of the good. In the background, though, the figure of Gorgias remains, the master of style, who shows that the instruments Aristotle wants to use for noble purposes can just as easily serve ignoble ones. If you place Gorgias alongside the other figures in your series, Parmenides with his uncompromising being, Protagoras with his hewn measure, the early Stoics with their cosmic logos, his uniqueness becomes clear. They offer visions of order, even if those orders differ. He offers a vision of unsteady ground. They search for what is beneath appearance. He dwells in the realm of appearance and asks how it functions. They dream of escaping the flux of opinion. He dives into it and learns how to swim. Yet it would be a mistake to think that he has no anchor at all. There is evidence, scattered and indirect, that Gorgias valued moderation, that he warned against the excesses of arrogance and cruelty. A teacher who lived as long as he did, moving among rival cities and factions, would have seen more than enough of what happens when language is used to whip people into frenzies of hatred or false hope. Even if he did not write moral treatises, he lived with the consequences of rhetoric. It is possible to imagine him, late in life, watching a younger speaker imitate his style but twist it toward sheer demagoguery, and feeling something like unease. Following the unfolding story of Western moral philosophy, Gorgias can be presented as a turning point where we are forced to ask, how much of what we call morality is, in fact, a matter of who gets to speak and how? Laws can be written in dense prose or stirring phrases. Declarations of rights can be phrased to include some and exclude others. A leader can justify violence as defense or condemn the same violence as atrocity, depending on the narrative frame. Gorgias does not invent these realities, but he exposes and dramatizes them. In the end, he leaves us with a kind of double vision. On one level, we must continue the philosophical search for more adequate accounts of justice, courage, temperance, and the good life. On another level, we must never forget that any such account will live in language, and that language is always already a field of struggle. Whoever hopes to speak about morality without attending to its rhetorical dimension runs the risk of being outmaneuvered by those who do attend to it. Gorgias, the man from Leontini who walked into Athens with a cloak full of rhythms and reversals, is not the hero of this story. He does not offer a model society or a rule by which all values can be measured, but he is an indispensable antagonist. The figure who forces the champions of truth and justice to sharpen their own sense of what they are doing when they speak. Without him, and without the discomfort he provokes, Western moral philosophy would tell itself a flatter, safer, and less honest story.
Midnight rails under silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Some soul, every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Thank you. nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Thank you.